I'm Paul Harris, proud to have you along every afternoon from 2 until 6 here on the 50,000-watt blowtorch, News Talk 1120 KMOX, available worldwide with our online audio via KMOX.com. My next guest was an advisor to two presidents, a key figure in four presidential transitions, a member of the National Security Council, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, and when she became the first female Secretary of State, she became the highest-ranking woman to ever serve in U.S. government up to that point. I believe Nancy Pelosi has passed you since then.
She has. Right? I was very glad to give it up to her.
Dr. Madeleine Albright is here. Her new book is called Memo to the President-Elect, How Can We Restore America's Reputation and Leadership? She is in St. Louis to be part of the St. Louis Speaker Series at Powell Symphony Hall tonight at 8 o'clock, and it's a pleasure to meet you in person.
Great to be with you, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Everybody saw you in that picture of Hillary Clinton in Iowa. On the night that she lost the caucuses to Barack Obama, you were there, Wesley Clark was there, President Clinton was there. The next week when she won New Hampshire, you were nowhere to be seen.
That's not true. I was in New York talking about my book my book was being released on that day in New York City.
So that's why you weren't in New Hampshire.
Right. And I was on the Today Show and I was doing all kinds of things. I'd been in New Hampshire. I went from Iowa to New Hampshire. So that was just a coincidence.
Are you serving as an advisor to Mrs. Clinton?
I am, yes.
What is that role?
Well, I am not really on the an official in the campaign, but I often go out and do some surrogate speaking. I have known Senator Clinton for a very long time. I obviously got to know her much, much better when I was in the Clinton administration. When I was ambassador to the United Nations, she would come up to New York fairly frequently, meet with the delegations there. They all were very impressed with her. They wanted to know if this is what Eleanor Roosevelt was like, but I didn't know Eleanor Roosevelt, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
When I was secretary, she took a lot of trips on America's behalf, and I sometimes went with her and briefed her. So I have had a kind of a friend-advisor relationship with her for a long time, but I'm just part of a group of people that talk about national security policy with her.
So you're one of the people she turns to when she needs to figure out what am I going to say about Iraq and Iran and China and Al-Qaeda?
Well, she has a group of very diverse people that help her with that, and that's what I like about her. And one of the things I advise in my book is that whoever the next president is, and this is a book designed for whoever it is, Democrat or Republican, male or female, that it's important to have a group of advisors with diverse voices of different ages. And that's certainly what Senator Clinton has now.
What do you see as the primary foreign relations challenge for the next president?
The fact that the world is such a mess, that's a diplomatic term of art. And the problem is that there are so many issues out there that are going to have to be dealt with. And one of the big problems is how to prioritize them. But I do think up front and center is the war in Iraq and how to end it. And increasingly, what to do about Pakistan and Iran. Those are the central kinds of things in the war in Afghanistan. But then there are a lot of issues to which not enough attention has been paid recently, and so it's a very full plate. And the purpose of my book is to kind of explain those issues, but also to point out that it's going to be a very hard presidency.
I think it is also. I think any presidency in the 21st century is going to be very, very difficult. Well, let's talk about Iraq for just a moment. One of the things that I don't like to do is talk about all the decisions that have already been made, because they've been rehashed about a billion times.
Totally agree with you.
So tell me what you see as the potential end game from here forward in Iraq.
Well, I think the decision has to be made to get out of Iraq, that we have to make clear that we do not want to be there permanently, that we don't want to have permanent bases. So the question is how to increase the sense that the Iraqis can deal with their own security, that there are not incursions from other countries, and that the problem of Al-Qaeda in Iraq is dealt with. And so systematically, decisions have to be made about how to withdraw the American forces in a way that does not create chaos or a vacuum. So in an organized way, but also doing everything possible to train up the Iraqis. I think there also has to be involvement by other countries. I have said something not too popular in Europe, but basically that the U.S. did not start World War I or World War II, but when we saw that it affected our national interests, we went in there and turned it around. While countries might have disagreed with how we got there, I think that if they look at the situation in Iraq, they have to recognize that it affects their national interest as much as it does ours, perhaps even more. So they need to get in there and help in terms of the reconstruction parts of it and in training the Iraqis. I also think that there have to be decisions made about a surge in diplomacy, of trying to get the neighboring countries to understand the problems there, deal with the refugee outflow, try to be helpful in securing the borders of Iraq. I was very troubled today in reading a story in the New York Times which said that one of the leading officials of the Iraqi government said basically that the U.S. would have to stand till 2018. I believe that we have to make clear that we can't stay that long. There could be some kind of a normal status of forces agreement that we have with other countries, but I think we have to end our role in this war.
Yeah, the Iraqi minister who said that we'd be there 10 years, John McCain, has been quoted in the last week or so as saying that we need to be in Iraq, or even on Meet the Press, he said we may need to be there for 100 years, and he says, look how long we've been in Korea, look how long we've been in Germany, look how long we've been in various other places. Why would we not want to have a permanent base in Iraq in the same way?
Well, I think because we are dealing with a very different kind of a country and also a different relationship with Muslim countries. I think that's one of the issues that was certainly absent in the cases that you stated that came after a war where there was a frankly totally defeated enemy. There was an alliance structure. Each one of those situations is different. But I think that we have one of the issues that causes terrorism, and we're not totally sure what causes terrorism, but one is the presence of American forces on Muslim land. And the question is how one deals with that in the future in a way that protects our national interest but does not expose our forces to greater threats, or does what I think is the major problem out there for the next president is how to fight terrorism without creating more anti-Americanism. But I do think, and I alluded to this, and this is my personal position, is that maybe down the road there will be a way, if there is a stable Iraqi government, that then can sign what is known as a status of forces agreement, as we have with the countries that you mentioned. Then maybe down the road one might have some forces there. But I think that's a different question than how to get the forces out now to end this war.
It's News Talk 1120 KMOX. Paul Harris talking with Dr. Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State and author of a new book called Memo to the President-Elect, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. You talked about American forces on foreign soil. Osama bin Laden was the one who said that our forces in Saudi Arabia were an affront to Islam, and that was one of the reasons behind his hatred of America. Yesterday, President Bush met with Saudi King Abdullah and said that he was going to allow $20 billion worth of new high-tech arms to be sold to the Saudis, including precision-guided bombs, part of what he calls an overall U.S. strategy to bolster the defenses of oil-producing Gulf nations like Saudi Arabia against threats from countries like Iran. Now, I was talking about this yesterday with Senator Claire McCaskill. She says she needs to find out more about this, but at first sight, she doesn't see anything wrong with that. Do you?
Well, I do think we all need to know more. But one of the things that actually you pointed out initially that I'd served in the Carter administration, at that time, there were some arms sales that were a combination of some sales to Israel and then some to Saudi Arabia. And that was one of the first times it was a real question and an issue. I do think that there is no reason not to be supporting countries that help us in a number of different ways. The question is what kind of arms they are. There are always this discussion about what is offensive and what is defensive. We clearly have a relationship with Saudi Arabia. They were quite helpful to us during the time that we were in office in terms of dealing. If you remember, there were sanctions on Iraq, and among the things were no-fly zones in the north and the south, and there had to be places for refueling and a variety of ways that one needed support in the region. So the Saudis are a complex relationship for us, but one has to know what it all involves. adding arms to the region generally is not something that I think helps. But they, and I'm not sure I quite understood President Bush's rationale on it, but I think there are going to be questions. It'll be up to Congress to really examine that arms sale.
Part of my problem with Saudi Arabia, and I've discussed it on the show quite often, even with the Saudi ambassador here in the studio, is they keep calling themselves our partners in peace. And yet they don't do enough to fight back against Wahhabism in their own country. They have madrasas where young Saudis are learning to become the Osama bin Ladens of tomorrow and to hate America and to hate Israel and to hate some of their other neighbors in the Middle East. This is the place that was the birthplace of Al-Qaeda. It may have grown up elsewhere, but it was born in Saudi Arabia. And there are huge human rights violations. You, as a woman, can't go and drive in Saudi Arabia. You know, having made trips there, how you were treated as a second-class citizen. At what point do all of these things, including the human rights components, have to become part of our foreign policy towards a nation that, frankly, I consider to be kind of dangerous to us?
Well, I actually was never treated as a second-class citizen because I came as the United States of America.
Okay.
But I understand what you're saying. And I think that it is one of the most complicated relationships we have because we are so dependent on a lot of their oil, also because they have a place of power within the region. And it is very complicated, but all the things you say are true. The question is whether there is a way to encourage King Abdullah to, first of all, deal with the problems of the extremism, and they are as much a threat to him as they are to us, and then begin to open up the system, because it's a very fragile system in many ways, and kind of in many ways questionable about its long-term survival. There are an awful lot of princes and various members of the royal family. When the oil prices were not as high as they are now, there were questions about why they had all the money, and a lot of the normal population of Saudi Arabia didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But it revolves around the fact that we are so dependent on their oil, which then goes to the other big issue that the next president is going to have to handle, that whole bundle of issues to do with global warming and security, energy security, and a movement towards some kind of independence for the United States, not to be dependent on exactly the kinds of things you say about Saudi Arabia.
So if they didn't have the oil, we wouldn't be treating them this way at all.
Well, the oil plays a huge role, but also its geographical location. And if you look at the Persian Gulf and all the aspects of choke points in terms of the way the maritime trade of the world moves and the size of Saudi Arabia, you can't ignore it. So I think the best thing to do is to deal with them in a way that makes it evident that they ultimately have to change a lot of their ways. But a lot of what you say, it's very hard to deny. And their arguments are, and I just state their arguments, is that they have to have some latitude in dealing with the extremists within their societies, that they are looking at ways to reform things. But I have to tell you, I found them the most complicated of relationships, because they were helpful in a variety of ways, and yet exactly the kinds of problems on human rights issues and on the fact that Wahhabism really took root there are all true.
Knowing that you were coming on here today, I was looking around on the internet for some stories about you, and I found one written by a guy from the Business and Media Institute. I don't know what that is. Do you?
No.
Okay. The headline is Albright, : Bush, one of the worst presidencies in history. And it's got you in quotes there.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say that this is one of the worst presidencies in history?
I think it's the jury is still out, frankly, because there's still some months to go, and there have been some improvements, I think, in diplomacy. But I think this is a presidency that's not going to go down well in history.
Why?
Because it has in many ways squandered American power. I loved representing the United States. It's a great honor. I wasn't born in the United States, and so to sit behind that sign that says United States is an unbelievable honor. And while I don't think that the world has to be grateful to us, I do think it's important to be respected. And according to a lot of surveys, and by the way, I am co-chair of an attitude survey with former Senator Danforth, America's reputation throughout the world is sinking rapidly. And one shouldn't care, except that it makes it very hard to provide what elected officials are supposed to do for the U.S. to protect the American people if our power is questioned. And I do think that Iraq is going to go down in history as the greatest disaster in American foreign policy, meaning that it's worse than Vietnam, not in the number of Americans who died, obviously, or Vietnamese or Iraqis, but in terms of the unintended consequences. And we've talked about a couple of them already. But, for instance, I think one can argue well today that actually Iran is the country that has gotten the most out of the war in Iraq. We are now concerned about the growing reach and influence of Iran, their desire to do we don't know what with nuclear power. And so that is one of the big problems. And that we really, our reputation and our leadership is being questioned, which hurts us as Americans.
You've written a book called Memo to the President-Elect. What's your memo to the next president about Iran? What do we do?
Well, I think that we have to recognize how dangerous it is, but also to understand that you have to deal with your enemies in a way where you're talking to them in order to deliver some pretty tough messages. So I am advocating engagement with Iran to deal with the problems. Diplomacy is not appeasement. And some people say that. I don't believe that. I think diplomacy is the way that countries talk to each other, delivering some pretty tough messages. And I was known for doing that at various times. I also think that it is important to get them subjected to international inspection. According to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, they actually have a right to nuclear power. They don't have a right to secret programs. But what is interesting is how confused we are about Iran now. Several weeks before the holidays, there was a national intelligence estimate all of a sudden that came out that said that they had given up their nuclear program. It was interesting. I happened to have been in Israel at the time it came out. The Israelis were a little surprised and had a different opinion. But mainly we don't know what's going on in Iran. And so it is a much more complicated society in terms of some people who are more pro-American than others. Ahmadinejad now is somebody that the Ayatollahs, who are the basic leaders of Iran, are losing confidence in him because he hasn't done what he should on the economy. And he also, I'm not sure they object to his crazy statements, but it has not helped. So what I'm saying is it has to be a very big issue dealt with differently. And one of the things about my book that I've done, Paul, is to talk about in the first part, if foreign policy, I say this to my students, that foreign policy is just trying to get some country to do what you want. That's all it is. So what are the tools? What's in the national security toolbox? And I wouldn't take any tools off the table. I would use diplomacy and economic sticks and carrots. And I would reserve the use of force tool, knowing full well that the costs of using force are huge, but you don't take it off the table.
One of the interesting things to me about the Middle East is that there is so much talk about Iran, and only in the last few weeks with the assassination of Benazir Bhutto has there been a lot more attention paid to what's going on in Pakistan, which I consider to be a bigger threat only because of the volatility of that country and the complete lack of control that Musharraf seems to have within his own country. Is my read right?
Absolutely. And one of the things I say in my book is that Pakistan has all the elements of what gives you a migraine. It has a nuclear weapon, it has terrorism, corruption, poverty, extremism, and it's located in an area of great importance to us. Afghanistan is not going particularly well at the moment. And I so supported President Bush in his action against Afghanistan after 9/11, but we all took our eye off the ball in order to do Iraq. And so Afghanistan is not going well, and there was a greater dependence on Pakistan as kind of a staging area for fighting the Taliban. And now there is increased confusion there. I think that it's unclear what is going to happen if there are supposed to be elections in February. that have been delayed, whether there can be some kind of a coalition government. Today, again, just to show I really have read the papers today, there is a totally terrifying story in the New York Times about how the intelligence group in Pakistan has basically lost control over some of the militants that they were harboring in order to, according to this story, have some way of dealing with what they consider, from their perspective, a threat, India in Kashmir, as well as trying to have control of some of the parts that are going on in Afghanistan. So you have all these elements there in a country that we need very badly in order to deal with the problems in Afghanistan. So a migraine is definitely what this creates.
Dr. Madeleine Albright's new book is called Memo to the President-Elect, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. She will be signing copies of it when she speaks tonight as part of the St. Louis Speaker Series at Powell Symphony Hall at 8 o'clock. I want to talk about something that I find a little bit goofy in your book.
Yeah.
Goofy in a really fun way. On pages 72 and 73, you talk about the things you learn to say or not to say when you are on foreign trips. For instance, the difference between the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Gulf and the Gulf of Mexico. You got to be careful what you refer to as the Gulf. And you go into a story about Y2K and the Chinese. Would you share that story?
Well, basically, there was the whole issue as to whether there was going to be the millennium bug and how we would deal with Y2K.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't understand what we were talking about. And I got into a terrible discussion about the millennium bug. But I have a story that I didn't put in there about it. I was somewhere in the Caribbean. And I misunderstood the issue, and I thought that they were talking about some kind of bug that was eating the crops. And I had this whole long discussion about the bug, and then they said, no, no, it's the millennium bug. So yeah, you can get yourself into all kinds of problems. But the Chinese story is a good one.
But the problem with the Chinese was they don't use our calendar.
No, they don't. And they, you know, they're in 1,000-something or other, and for them, 2000 was not exactly a big deal.
Well, it wasn't a big deal at all. What is a night note?
Well, that's a very interesting question and comment, because what happens is the bureaucracy of the United States is huge and creates an incredible amount of paper. And the President of the United States is obviously the ultimate consumer of all the paper. And there's a process whereby if you have something through the system, you send it to the National Security Council, and they then write a memo on top of it and say, on the issue of, let's take Kosovo, the State Department wants to do this, the Defense Department wants to do that, and I, the National Security Advisor, think this is what should happen. And it really goes through a bureaucratic shredding machine in many ways. But what you can do as a night note is for the Secretary of State to privately write a note to the President of the United States, which doesn't go through this whole system. And some secretaries, I mean, I talked on the phone a lot to President Clinton, but also it is a way to get a communication through that doesn't have to be homogenized. And it's a very good mechanism. The hard part, and I write about this in the book, is that President Clinton would write back, but he had completely indecipherable handwriting.
Is that right?
Totally. It was all, you know, it was left-handed, and it was all kind of, and you'd read it, and you'd have to call up and say, so what do you think he really said on this?
So he would write notes in the margin?
He'd write notes on the margin. Now, that was a lot better than President Carter, who would correct your spelling.
Give you a B- for
you
your note?
Say, you know, what's the matter with yours?
Is it hard when you're the Secretary of State or a member of the NSC, which you also were, to disagree with the president face-to-face? This is the most powerful man in the world. Can you go up to him and say, you know what, you're completely wrong about that?
Well, I'll tell you, and that is one of the most important points that I think we have to look at for the next president. I think it's absolutely essential to have a president who will not cut you off at the knees if you decide to disagree. And it is very important to disagree with the president if you really have a disagreement. And to be able to state your arguments clearly, because sometimes you're with the president by yourself, but a lot of times it's in meetings with other officials of the national security team, And they have their arguments, you have yours. And what I found so great about President Clinton was he actually liked it when you disagreed with him. He would challenge and he would ask questions, but there was not a premium for saying, yes, sir, you're absolutely brilliant, and that is the way we need to go. So one of the things that I'm saying in the book is that we need a president who is confident, which means somebody who has a set of ideas and principles, but confident enough to listen to other people's ideas, curiosity to learn more, and not a president who is so certain that all the answers are right there and therefore doesn't push himself or herself in order to ask more questions. But it isn't easy. I have to tell you, it is not easy to disagree with the president. And there is something about sitting in the Oval Office.
Little daunting,
but it's essential to be done.
The book is called Memo to the President-Elect, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. It's brand new. It's going to be a bestseller by Dr. Madeleine Albright, our former Secretary of State, who will be speaking at Powell Symphony Hall at 8 o'clock tonight as part of the St. Louis Speaker Series. We've put the book up on KMOX.com. You click on our bookstore there, and when you buy it, a portion of the proceeds will go to help out St. Louis Children's Hospital.
Delighted about that.
So it's very wonderful to meet you, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I loved being on with you, Paul. Thank you.
Madeleine Albright here on the Paul Harris Show.